You're listening to the Cycling Podcast at the Vuelta a España in association with Rafa, celebrating the sport and producing the finest cycling clothing since 2004. Today we are in Nîmes.
Where are we, Lionel?
We're in, not Spain, we're in Nîmes, the most Spanish of all French towns, I would say.
Well, it is today.
It certainly is today, because the Vuelta a España has kicked off here with a team time trial, which went through the Roman amphitheatre here, which has hosted the gladiatorial battles way back before even we were podcasting.
Wow.
Predates even that. They've also had bullfighting there, I think, so there's a bit of a Spanish flavour. Tonight, the town is really en fête, isn't it? We're at a tapas bar. It's a French restaurant, but they seem to be serving tapas this evening.
I should have said we were played in with some sounds from the amphitheatre. You were there for much of the afternoon, Lionel. I hope you applied the sun cream.
I sat in the shade, actually.
It looked spectacular. Yeah. My name's Richard Moore. That's Lionel Burney. And we're joined by our special Vuelta guest, Fran Reyes.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, my friends.
Fran's made a terrible error already by losing his voice in the week leading up to the Vuelta. But
don't blame me. Blame the air conditioning.
He almost did a Sammy Sanchez and had to be expelled on the eve of the race. But I'm sure we'll get on to Sammy Sanchez later on. But Fran is going to be joining us throughout the Vuelta coverage. Fran is a journalist, you live in the south of Spain. Fran, where are you from? Granada?
I am from Granada, proudly living there since 4 years ago, before living in Malaga and Almeria.
You have a lot of knowledge, obviously, of the Vuelta, of the Spanish riders and teams, so we're going to be, well, tapping into some of your expertise over the next 3 weeks. We'll be joined as well by Daniel Freib. He's supposed to be joining us tonight, but not sure where he's gone, but he will be joining us most nights. Lionel, you'll be here for the first week. I'll be here the first 2 weeks. You're coming back for the final week. So we're doing a bit of a shift.
Squad rotation again, isn't it? Very similar to our Giro d'Italia coverage in that sense, I guess.
Yeah, and we'll be producing nightly episodes and morning episodes of Kilometre Zero. We'll give you a bit of information about that later on in the show. But the Vuelta did start today. I was noting that the Marseille is just 63 miles away from here, 100 kilometres. It was there that we finished our Tour de France, of course, in the Stade Vélodrome, on what was quite a flat occasion, really. It promised much, having the start and finish of the time trial in the stadium. Didn't really deliver. There were lots of reasons for that, I think, but the crowd wasn't great in the stadium. The atmosphere wasn't good. Nîmes today was a total contrast, a much smaller town, but it was absolutely stunning. The course was spectacular to watch. Not all the riders necessarily liked it, and we'll hear a bit about that later on. But it was, I mean, it made for fantastic TV coverage, and the crowds were enormous. And the atmosphere and the way it looked in the amphitheatre was phenomenal.
Yeah, it was a wonderful setting because it's such a beautiful building. It was built apparently in the year 70 AD, so it's a couple of thousand years old. And it's quite a remarkable thing, because perhaps it's because I come from England, where you would expect there to be signs up warning everybody to be careful on the uneven surface, or don't go here because this is dangerous. The steps are very uneven, slippery, broken in places, of course. But everyone was quite happily sitting inside the amphitheatre watching the cycling. And, you know, there was probably a couple of thousand people in there, I would say, because it's not huge, although it does dominate the town centre. But it was the most appropriate setting for the race, which went straight through the middle of the amphitheatre, didn't it? Whereas the Stade Vélodrome, it didn't really fill, the Tour de France didn't really expand to fill the Stade Velodrome, which has got 60,000 seats, of course, and it felt a bit of a flat afternoon there. This was the complete opposite, and I think it was because the size of the event matched the size of the venue perfectly.
That's true. After all, maybe the Stade Velodrome was big, but this felt warm. You know, this was according to the personality of the event of the Vuelta a España.
I was going to ask you, Fran, actually, as a Spaniard, your home tour, what does it feel like to be on French soil for the start of the Vuelta?
There's actually this school of thought that says that every Grand Tour should begin on its country, begin and finish on its country, but I am not really fond of that. Also, I would say that in this particular case, Nîmes feel very close to Spain, both from a geographical but also from a cultural point of view. After all, this is almost a Spanish city on its layout, on its display. Sharp, narrow streets, the bullfighting arena, of course, and all these terraces with bars and tapas being served, that definitely has a Spanish flavor.
The team time trial. I mean, I'm a big fan of team time trials generally, but especially when they open a race and when they happen on these technical courses, which, as I mentioned earlier, the riders aren't universally fond of for obvious reasons, because there are safety factors. And you and I, Lionel, had lunch at a sort of terrace restaurant as the riders came out of the amphitheater. We were watching them warm up. So most teams did two laps at least, and we were watching the teams go around. And while we were sitting there having lunch, two teams suffered quite bad mishaps. David De La Cruz came off when Quickstep swung out of the amphitheatre onto the road, and there was a vehicle coming towards him which shouldn't have been there. It wasn't moving fast or anything, but it caused a reaction in the string of riders, and David De La Cruz came down. He was unhurt. And then Joe Dombrowski also came off for Cannondale, coming up through the tunnel out of the amphitheatre. So it's quite a dramatic lunch. You didn't leave your lunch.
I did.
I sprinted away from the table to see what was happening. I turned around, saw Lionel tucking into his tuna.
Well, the reason for that was because I knew you would take some photographs of what had happened, and I'd be able to see what had happened to De La Cruz and later Dombrowski. So I didn't need to move. I had my reporter on the spot. But let's turn our attention then to the race, and I'll give a brief rundown each night.
I forgot about
that.
Yeah,
we normally kick off an episode with the tale of the tapper at the Giro, tale of the attack at the Tour de France, and tale of the etapa here at the Vuelta. As you said, Rich, a 13.7-kilometre team time trial here in Nîmes. The Vuelta has really made this an opening day custom in recent years, starting with a team time trial, and BMC won it, as they did 2 years ago. It was a bit of a farce a couple of years ago down at Puerto Banús, because the course was deemed to be too technical. They were going on a sort of marbly pavement that was next to the sea, and they covered it over with some carpet, but they decided to neutralise the times for GC that day. They didn't do that today, and there were quite a few crashes, quite a few time gaps as well, but it was BMC Racing who won. They were the only team to break 16 minutes for the 13.7 kilometres. And that's put Rowan Dennis, the Australian rider, into the red jersey. So he is the first overall leader of the Vuelta. Interesting that TJ Van Garderen is in their lineup. Don't want to heap a load of pressure on the American rider, because we've done that in Grand Tours before. But with some hilly-ish stages coming up, that makes him, puts him in a good position. In terms of how the rest of the teams did, well, it was the team time trial specialists that performed the best, as you would expect. Quickstep Floors were second, Sunweb were third, Team Sky were fourth, and Orica Scott were just behind them. So it's been a good day for Chris Froome, Team Sky's leader. He's put, I think, 26 seconds already into Alberto Contador of Trek Segafredo. They didn't ride too badly, but not a great day for them. The other thing to note from the amphitheatre was just how popular the French teams were. Not surprising, as we're on French soil. Cofidis probably got their biggest cheer of the season going through the middle of the amphitheatre this afternoon. And Richard, just before we move on to talk about the stage, should also mention that positive test for Samuel Sanchez, the former Olympic champion. Of course, BMC rider would have been here, but he's tested positive for a growth hormone, awaiting the B sample to confirm or not. whether an anti-doping rule violation suspension will be imposed on him. But that does make it the full set of Grand Tours, which have kicked off with a minor-ish doping scandal. I don't want to downplay here,
well,
but...
I wouldn't say minor.
Yeah,
I
mean, Bardiani had two riders kicked out of the Giro
and with
on the eve.
And with a rider like Sanchez, who, with the career he's had, it casts a shadow over everything he's done. Obviously, we will get on to talk about that.
Well, let me qualify that then, because I mean, I'm remembering 10, 11 years ago when the Tour de France used to kick off with not just a small explosion, but an absolutely amazing doping scandal would erupt on the eve of the Tour. So in the context of what we've known in the past, fairly minor, but obviously a blow for the sport and a blow for BMC Racing.
Well, you mentioned there, Lionel, that the fact that four of the top five teams were teams that are specialists and have really dominated team time trials over recent years. The one surprise package maybe was Sunweb, a very young team, and I was surprised to see them up there. But the other teams are all familiar teams in the top three or four of team time trials. And what's surprising about that is that the personnel isn't necessarily the same. That there seems to be something in the team's DNA, whether it's Quickstep, Orica, Team Sky and BMC, where they, it doesn't seem to matter which riders they field, they always seem to produce good team time trials. And this is something that really interested me. And I spoke after the stage with Marco Pinotti, the really tight time trial coach at BMC, whose job it is to get the team ready for an event like today, just to find out how they prepared for this. And here's what he had to say. Here's Marco Pinotti.
So you're the man behind every successful BMC time trial, team time trial. I mean, you must have been pleased with what you saw out there.
Every time it's amazing, but I'm behind, but who's in front are the riders. And so it's the training, the commitment, and materials, everything. And every time it's a surprise. I mean, it's not people say we are the favorite, but everybody else has two legs and nine bikes. And nine
it's funny because we were very uncertain about today, because although there are teams like Quickstep, BMC, Sky, Orica, who are all very good team time trial squads, they didn't necessarily have their best riders here, and yet we still see those same teams at the top. It suggests that there's something in those teams that makes them good at team time trialing. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, it's about equipment, about training, and about being able to suffer. So the more you do it, the more you do it again, and so it's a practice. And I mean, I can speak for our team. We put a lot of commitment into this, so We have been winning through a very different range of riders. Today we have Franchini and Loic, the first year. For them was the second time trial of their career. Franchini won in Catalonia, one year. Loic is the first one. It was last year in Burgos. So we have a key riders, but then across the team, everyone gives his contribution. It's always a team effort.
How did you prepare for this one then? I mean, you weren't able to ride the circuit, I don't think, until today.
Personally, I know the course four times, one every day, and twice in the car today. So I know every millimeter of the course, because I know the rider only had the possibility to rode today, and he did it twice. Who was pulling and when and what he had to do. So it was as usual, a long planning behind this.
So you were out here personally riding it, filming it as well?
No, filming, because when I rode the course, it was like 5 o'clock in the morning, and with the traffic. It was with the traffic light, so it was. But I rode the course at that time, yeah, every morning.
It was quite a dangerous course, quite a technical course. I think Lotto had a nasty crash. Do you have any misgivings about that, or do you think that's just part of the sport?
So when I saw the course, I thought it was technical, but then I don't think it was. There were 3 points, I would say, where you need to pay attention, and at the only moment when in the radio say caution. Then, of course, you ride on the limit and. Sometimes it's a crash. The thing is, when the crashes are often in this part, in a slow corner, you know, when you try to go a little bit faster, then there's no more grip. At least for what I heard, the crashes have been.
Great. And Ron Dennis is in the jersey. I mean, he must have been an important guy in that team today.
He's one of the strongest riders in time trial in the world, and a key element in our squad. So I think he deserves to wear the jersey on behalf of the whole team.
The RAFA Cycling Club is the largest global community of its kind. Members share their passion for the road through rides, events, exclusive club kits and racing. Find out more at rafa.cc.
Thank you very much indeed to RAFA. Without them, we wouldn't be here. They sponsor the podcast, and as well as the Vuelta, tonight, on Saturday, there was the Rafa Nocturne in Copenhagen, first ever Rafa Nocturne in Copenhagen. You can watch that if you want on Facebook. It was broadcast as a Facebook live event, but you can go onto the Rafa Facebook page and watch it after the event. And look out for reports as well on it on rafa.cc. But I'd say we're very grateful to Rafa for their support. So we heard from Marco Pinotti. We've actually been joined by Daniel Freib.
What's that got to do with Marco Pinotti?
That was quite a big introduction. No, I'm just saying we heard from Marco Pinotti and now we've been joined by Daniel Freib. How are you, Daniel?
Not well, Rich.
Why?
Not well. It's not been a good day, I'm not going to lie. Got a bit of a knock, got an Achilles problem. A month away from the British Speed Golf Championships, and which I'm worried about. It's Arsenal lost. It's not been a good day.
What about the race? Did you... Any thoughts on that?
Not really. No. Well, you know, Bardet's a bad time trialist. We knew that already.
Rohan Dennis.
How long is he going to keep his jersey?
Well, he was pretty unoptimistic about his... Pretty pessimistic is the word, I think, about his chances tonight in the press conference. He thought that he would probably lose it to Andorra in a couple of days.
It's interesting. I was talking to a couple of guys earlier and thinking about how someone like Wilco Kelderman, who really is at the time trialing end of GC riders, and Dennis is similar. I mean, Dennis has not really had a successful GC campaign up until now, but you never quite know how those guys are going to go in the Vuelta, because it's so particular and it's so different from the other Grand Tours. And, you know, with the small climbs and the steep climbs, and there are a couple of stages in this Vuelta that are untypical Vuelta stages. They're more like Giro stages, so the ones of Sierra Nevada, Calar Alto in the south of Spain. But there are a lot of the steep climbs at the end of stages which are typical Vuelta fare. And who knows how Dennis and Kelderman, they probably don't even know how they're going to fare on that kind of terrain.
I mean, somewhere for me were the surprise packages. I mean, Wilco Kelderman and Rohan Dennis are the guys who were knocked out of the Giro early on. I mean, both of them, Wilco Kelderman was there really to support Tom Dumoulin, but Rohan Dennis was at the Giro to see how he could go in GC. He was out very early on, wasn't it? It was the stage up to Etna that he crashed and didn't last much longer. And Kelderman was one of the guys caught up. Well, he was the guy that hit police motorbike, wasn't he, in the Giro on the stage to Blockhouse. Those two guys are two who have sort of, I think, talked down their prospects here, but they could, you know, they could do here what they wanted to do at the Giro.
They could do a Dumoulin.
I thought you were going to give us the Dumoulin song there. It felt like you were going
to... No, someone sent me a... Who was it? Someone sent me a Tom Dumoulin song today. I must listen to it. I haven't had time to listen to it yet, but that might have improved my day because it's been such a bad day.
Oh, cheer up. Well, listen, on Rohan Dennis, Fran, you interviewed Rohan Dennis earlier in the year. Daniel, you know all about Dennis's reputation for having a bit of a temper, but he told you a little bit about that, I think, Fran.
Yeah, it was a pretty interesting, intense interview on the BMC training camp in Dinia, and he came up to me like a pretty straightforward and even relaxed guy, which surprised me a bit because of the reputation he has in the peloton and also within his team of being rather interesting, different personality who didn't relate very well to both his teammates and the staff members. But when I found him, we spent half an hour chatting or so, and he told me a lot about this hot temper that is usually referred to as his biggest quality or his main characteristic as a person. And he told me how it dated back to his childhood days, because apparently back when he was just a child, he fought with his brother constantly, like 4 years until the teen years. At that point the fights ended, but it was because he just stopped talking to his brother at all, and that situation lasted for years until they came back to terms and began speaking again to each other. On the other hand, with his parents, he apparently has a very fluid relationship, even too close with his mother especially.
he was asked in a press conference about his teammate Samuel Sanchez and the positive test on the eve of the Vuelta. Lionel, you were listening to that. What did he say exactly?
Well, not much, really. I mean, he said that when observing a positive test from a distance, when it happens with another team, is one thing, but having it happen in his own team, he said, was very surreal. He did make the point, which we always have to remember, that until the B sample comes back and confirms the A sample, it's probably wrong to kind of condemn somebody. But he wasn't exactly... he wasn't exactly forthcoming about whether or not it had much impact on the team in the days leading up. I mean, most of the time, they just call up another rider and on they go. And, that is kind of yesterday's news. And that's really how cycling deals with these kind of things, isn't it? Everyone says, well, what a surprise this has been, and moves on and hopes that it doesn't get brought up too much. But it's a blow for BMC in the sense that Sanchez is a rider with an impressive list of wins. You know, he's been a very good one-day rider, particularly in his day. And to test positive for growth hormone at the age of 39 certainly raises questions, doesn't it? 38, I think he is.
Well, it raises questions, not least because I take your point about the B sample, but very rarely does a B sample deliver a different reading to an A sample. You always think with a case like this that the guy didn't just decide to do this in the autumn of his career. You know, inevitably you think, well, is this something that he's actually done his whole career?
Also, the growth hormone police are about to swing into action. I can hear sirens wailing because it wasn't growth hormone.
I love the idea of the growth hormone police.
Yeah, the growth hormone police. There is a peptide hormone that stimulates the production of your natural growth hormone. But is it? You know, I've been harping on in recent weeks about how we don't really know what's going on the doping front in professional cycling at the moment, because there have not been many positive tests in recent times, in recent months, in recent years. I would say we've got the beginnings of a pattern with this particular product, because it's the same product that Stefano Pirazzi and Nicola Ruffoni tested positive for on the eve of the Giro, which is interesting because it's not a product we'd heard much about prior to this year. And it's very difficult to detect. I think the kind of glow time, the detection window is pretty short, about 48 hours.
Well, they've only just been able to detect it, haven't they, in the last 18 months or so, I think. So, you know, that would probably explain why there's suddenly been, three high-profile positive cases on the eves of Grand Tours.
Yeah, as Daniel says, it's always uncertain when there are no positive cases or doping cases or investigations, because not knowing at all what's going on is sort of unsettling. And when riders are caught, it's sort of encouraging. I mean, a rider caught for doping is kind of good news for the sport in a way. But Fran, what do you make of it? I mean, Sammy Sanchez, a big figure in Spanish cycling. An open, friendly guy, in my experience. He's always been a good guy to interview. But how well do you know him, and what's your take on it?
Well, I've worked with Samuel Sanchez many times, and he's always been a quite professional rider, a quite professional person that was open to speak to the media, and that seemed to get on really well with his team and everything, even if his ego has been at times considered pretty big.
Really? Well, yeah. He's got a statue, of course, hasn't he?
Yeah, he has a statue in Gijón that was put in place maybe when he was 28, 30 years old, which is quite...
It's unusual. Unusual.
It's a quite young age to have a statue, but he likes that, you know? He has statued his gold medal and everything, and he's always referring to himself as an Olympic champion and remembering that he's an Olympic champion. He has been recently sporting these special shoes that they made for him with gold reflexes and colors. Yeah.
Can I interrupt here? I'm really intrigued by this. He often refers to himself as Olympic champion. So when he's at home with his wife, for example, does he shout up, Olympic champion is going to get some cornflakes. Olympic champion is going to bed now. How does it work?
I don't know, if he goes to meet with the teacher of his children, he always says, okay, Olympic champion coming, Olympic champion sitting, Olympic champion willing to learn more about his Olympic children. He's a very nice guy, and more or less I'd say that was kind to his teammates and kind to his people around him. What has really struck me of this positive test is not the fact that he was doping or not, you know, or he has doped or not, because after all, he belongs to a dark era. And, well, more or less, we can think whatever we want, and we can maybe put him in the same box as all the people that rode with him back in the noughties. And indeed, he has...
The naughty noughties.
Yeah, and indeed, he has tested positive twice as an amateur for different steam ones. And the fact that shocked me, actually, was that he had been doping at this age and at this situation. I learned today that his contract wasn't sorted out for next year, which may be a factor for pressure or for willing to perform, but
he's been on the verge of retirement before. Yeah. I mean, he's talked about retiring before, and he did say that he had intended to retire after the Vuelta. So, yeah. I don't know, I spoke to a few riders about it last night at the team's presentation as well, and they understood differently that they thought he was looking for a big performance to get a contract for next year. There was talk of him maybe going to one of the new French teams.
Yeah, there were talks of Fortuneo and Vital Concept, because apparently what was sounding on the grapevine was that Orbea was going to furnish with bikes some French team, but by what I spoke today with some different people, it seems that Orbea is not jumping with any new French team. So that kind of takes down all that possibility of Samuel Sanchez joining a French team. There was also the possibility of extending his contract with BMC, but yeah, he's probably looking for a good performance. But point is, being 39 years old, having already some projects outside of the professional cycling, like his junior and amateur team with the support of the MMR brand from Asturias, I think it's quite late in his career as to play with fire.
It's quite remarkable, really, when you actually think about it now, as the sort of the evening is wearing on here, where the sport is at. Samuel Sanchez was going to be in the BMC team a couple of days ago. He's tested positive. He kicked out of the race. They win the stage, win the red jersey, and you know, there isn't any kind of sense of, you know, inquisition, if you like, or outrage, or, you know, there's not the sort of the driving kind of criticism of BMC that you would get if it was, for example, if it was Sky, for example. I mean, it's quite a remarkable situation, really, when you think about it. That he's one of their marquee riders, and he's not here. It's his home race. He's not here. And, you know, they've won the stage, and I think probably got away a bit lightly this evening, you know. And the fact they've managed to kind of brush it off and say, well, you know, let's see what happens with the B sample. And, you know, yes, it's a big shock. It's a big surprise. I mean, it doesn't suggest to me that an awful lot, you know, there's not an awful lot of soul searching going on within teams when this kind of thing happens. I would have thought there'd be some, you know, some fists on the table saying, look, what the hell is going on here? But I don't get the sense with BMC that would be the case anyway.
The news were pretty shocking, but there's also have been a lot of things going on in the following hours of the announcement. You know, even with the Contador Presser, the build-up of the race, and besides the cycling world, we had all the Barcelona terrorist attack that probably with its buzz did brush off the agenda, all the talk about Samuel Sanchez, I guess.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much indeed to Science and Sport for sponsoring us throughout this year. And a reminder that all our listeners can get 20% off Science and Sport products at scienceandsport.com. Enter the code CPAUG20 for 20% off all your Science and Sport products. I met yesterday Hayden Groves, who is one of the team riding all three Grand Tours one day ahead of the race. Hayden is a former chef of the year, and he's also writing a cookbook about his journey around Italy, France and Spain. And I met him just after he'd ridden the team time trial, and he rode stage one today, but he did so without any of his luggage, which went missing en route. So he's borrowing shorts and jerseys and so on, and hopefully it'll turn up. But we will hear from Hayden during the Vuelta, so listen out for that. So I mentioned earlier that the course wasn't universally popular today. It was quite technical, quite narrow in places, uneven road surface. It claimed a couple of victims even in the warm-up. And in the race itself, the team that had suffered a really nasty crash was Lotto NL Jumbo. Two of their young riders, Antoine Tolhoek and Forrest de Tir, had a really nasty crash, high-speed crash. One of them just seemed to lose control on the entry into a corner.
Yeah, it's interesting, Rich. You spoke to George Bennett about the course. So shall we first of all hear from Lotto NL Jumbo's George Bennett about, well, what he thought of the technical nature of the course today?
See what happened with the crash there.
I didn't say it, but they just rode into a pothole. I think it was a pretty silly course. I mean, they love a spectacle, but like, you know, last year in the Vuelta they did a beautiful team time trial course, you know, where you can work together, you can really... aerodynamics, power, technique, all that stuff. And here was just a rip around a city with holes and, you know, like, I mean, sure, it looked nice on TV, but...
Dangerous, though.
Yeah, really dangerous. With the holes in the road like that, and you got nine guys ripping around on TT bikes, not touching your brakes, and...
You've got a couple of teammates look quite bashed up. Doesn't look very nice. A couple of younger guys as well. But I guess for you, the race, as you said, well, it's all about later on and when the race gets into the climbs.
Really sucks for the young boys. Two young boys, first Grand Tour. Not how they wanted to start, but yeah, me personally, looking forward. I mean, I just need to get through the first week, keep getting healthier, keep improving, and yeah, it's all on the last week.
I can understand George Bennett's point of view there, because it wasn't to everyone's taste, the course. There were some tricky corners. It was narrow. You've got to think of a team time trial. It's a kind of a caterpillar, isn't it? And they all nine riders have got to get round these tight corners. But I do think that the test of the event is that all nine riders have to get round the corners, and they have to get round the course all together without pushing so hard that people in the middle or at the end of the line come to grief, or opening up gaps that then blow the team to pieces. Rowan Dennis made the point in the press conference that, and this is Marco Pinotti's philosophy, that smooth is fast, and that if you can get the ninth guy round the corner quickest, that's really the job of the team time trial. It isn't about getting the first two or three round as quick as you possibly can. It's about getting your scoring rider and your GC riders round as quickly as possible. And we saw that today. Some of the teams came unstuck, and sometimes I think they'd be better off riding a little more as a unit and losing 50 seconds or a minute than coming to grief and losing a minute and 10 seconds or a minute and 20 seconds and having riders hit the deck.
On the one hand, I have complete sympathy for George Bennett and his point of view. If you've watched two teammates crash like that, you're going to be angry and emotional at the finish line. You're going to be annoyed that the course made life difficult, and probably without it being so technical, the crash wouldn't have happened.
The other important thing is that when you're fourth or fifth or sixth in the line, you can't see the drain covers or the potholes, or you haven't got the best line, and so you're relying on the teammates in front to pick the best line through on the course. And we're talking about city streets here, where they're not perfect. They're not, you know, there are problems with them, cracks and potholes and what have you. These are all part of the race. And, you know, luck, unfortunately, does come into it on a day like this a lot more than perhaps you would think.
And a team time trial is spectacular on a course like that, rather than on a motorway or a drag strip. We want to, part of the skill, as you say, is negotiating the course. So I thought it was spectacular.
And unfortunately, no one really knows what happened with Antoine Tolhoek, because he rode straight past us at the finish line. We tried to interview him, and he told some Dutch colleagues at the finish line he doesn't do interviews. Not today. I don't want to do an interview today. He doesn't do interviews.
That's a bold move for a young rider, isn't it? Eh?
I mean, we've heard of riders not doing podcasts, but not doing
interviews.
Yeah. I'm slightly in awe of that approach.
It's amazing. We'll see how long that lasts. Anyway, Daniel, moving on. You've got some transfer news, I think.
Transfer
gossip.
Well, just been observing from afar some of the stuff that's been going on this week. Dan Martin has been unveiled by the United Arab Emirates team. We can call them that, can't we? The Emirates. What's the official name? It seems to change in every race.
UAE.
Abu Dhabi. He's been unveiled. David De La Cruz, that was a bit of a curveball. Him signing for Team Sky, going to Quickstep. We'd heard nothing about this, no rumours whatsoever. I understand what actually happened was that Team Sky made a move to buy De La Cruz out of his contract. He had a contract for next year, and Dave Brailsford, I think, got chatting with Patrick Lefebvre, and they established that Elia Viviani was in the same position, had a year left on his contract, and Viviani was someone who very much appealed to Quickstep. So they effectively did a swap deal, and De La Cruz is going to Sky. Don't really know what plans.
Like Panini stickers, isn't it?
It is. Well, maybe they were inspired by the Panini sticker album at the Giro. So not really sure what Sky's plans are for De La Cruz, but very strong rider. He was very strong in the Vuelta a Burgos recently. It'd be interesting to see how he gets on here. Of course, he crashed today in the warm-up, but Sky were that keen to have him that they contemplated buying him out of his contract. Sky have got a couple of spots left for next year. I think they might have quite a big... I think they've got 28 riders at the moment. They might even go to 30 next year. A couple of places up for grabs. I'm going to throw one into the mix here. I'm going to throw this grenade and stand back and see what happens. But one rider who I've heard on the grapevine, and this might be absolute border dash, won't be the first time you've heard a completely spurious, unsubstantiated rumour on the cycling podcast. One rider they might be interested in is TJ Van Garderen.
Whoa.
I've heard murmurings from Sky, or from close to Sky, that they have a plan to turn TJ Van Garderen into a domestic deluxe. That's the absolute a seven-star domestic.
It makes sense. He's out of contract.
Yeah.
He's at a crossroads in his career.
Think he'll go for it?
I think he probably would. No?
Yeah, I mean, he's ridden very strongly as a domestic recently.
Poland.
Tour of Poland.
Poland, he was exceptional as a domestic. Absolutely. Might relish the prospect of having that pressure removed that's been on him. Fran, have you got any transfer speculation, gossip, rumour?
I could tell you a few rumors because I have been lucky enough as to find out a couple of agents today and learn things. But the one that I have really worked on for these months was that both the Rada brothers haven't extended their contract with Movistar. And his agent told me today that they were going to negotiate with Trek Segafredo, who has been interested on bringing on especially Jesus Herrada, who seems to be a hidden gem in the Movistar team ranks, a hidden gem below all the hierarchy that is so strong in this Spanish team. So we may see him switch colors.
I mean, it's interesting. I mean, there have been a lot of quite, interesting transfers at a time when there isn't the same movement as there has been the last couple of years when teams have been disappearing. There are no teams disappearing. In fact, there are new teams starting up for next year. So the transfer market is more interesting than usual, perhaps. Riders, the scene is quite buoyant, but it makes it also very difficult. I was speaking to Aqua Blue last night. It makes it very difficult for a team like that to sign up the sort of riders they signed a year ago when teams were folding. The sort of rider they might be interested in are just not really on the market this year.
It's a bit like the podcast market, isn't it? That's been very active of late. People coming in, going.
Oh, yeah.
It's been very fickle, hasn't it? New faces, new names, new voices. Where's Francois Tomaso?
He's on holiday in Spain at the moment. It's remarkable, isn't it? He's in the country of the Vuelta, and yet he's not participating. But, Richard, here we are on the first day of the Vuelta. We ought to look ahead to what we're anticipating over the next 3 weeks. I'm here for the first week. I know what I'm looking forward to. All food related, of course.
Going to Andorra, I would imagine.
Oh, I really don't like Andorra. As a Spaniard, Fran, what's your view on Andorra?
Well, Andorra is a tiny country. We all go to buy electronic devices and cheap cigarettes.
Yeah, it's not a place that I would hurry back to. Had a pretty bad couple of days there at the Tour de France last year when there was a rest day in Andorra for really boring logistical reasons, like Andorra is not covered by the mobile phone network of Europe, so basically you don't get any data roaming, so you can't use your mobile phone normally, which for us is a real pain. And there was just an attitude of everyone I sort of came into contact with in hotels or bars or restaurants, there was a sense that we should be grateful that we're in Andorra. And yes, the scenery is lovely, but there's an atmosphere. It's a bit like I'm not a big fan of Switzerland for the same reason, but it's kind of got a hoity-toity air, as we say in Britain. No? Daniel's frowning. Hey, are you a fan of Andorra?
No, certainly not. But Switzerland, you can't lump Switzerland and Andorra together. They've got mountains in common, but that's about it, no?
Okay.
It's very expensive. Like, I mean, I think that's probably what Lionel means. I think it's very expensive.
Well, I mean, it is very expensive and unnecessarily so, I think. But
listen, I think we have got 3 weeks to look forward to. I think we will look forward to it, and maybe we'll do that tomorrow. Tomorrow's quite an interesting looking stage. We're expecting crosswinds tomorrow. One thing we should say, Lionel, about our coverage of the Vuelta is that a little change this year is that Kilometre Zero, that our morning show, which comes out Monday, Wednesday and Friday, first time we've done Kilometre Zero at the Vuelta, will be for friends of the podcast only. We did actually have a sponsor lined up for Kilometre Zero, which would have made it free, but sadly the sponsorship fell through at the last minute.
It did, and it's very much like when Rabobank sponsor pulled out and they had to be called Team Blanco for a year, didn't they? So our Kilometre Zero here at the Vuelta is very much a kind of Team Blanco version of Kilometre Zero, because our friends of the podcast are one of our sponsors. They help fund us covering the races from January through to December, and when we don't have a commercial sponsor, so to speak, we fall back on the support of our friends of the podcast.
Who was it, Napalm? Le Groupement?
Hang on.
Sony Ericsson?
I should say that this does give us an opportunity to say thanks again to All Press Espresso for sponsoring us at the Giro, Kilometre Zero at the Giro, and thank you also Niederberg Wines for sponsoring Kilometre Zero at the Tour de France.
Are we still in the market?
I mean, Sony Ericsson. Sony Ericsson were on the hook, I thought, for Kilometre Zero.
Someone comes in with a late bid. Transfer window only shuts on the 2nd of September.
At the Vuelta. I had these emails and everything confirming it.
I should just explain the Sony Ericsson reference there, Rich, because several years ago now, 10 years ago, Giancarlo Ferretti, who is a very well-respected Italian director sportif, he was in charge of the Fassa Bortolo team that Alessandro Petacchi rode for a number of years. He thought he had a new sponsor for his team. He thought he had Sony Ericsson on the hook, being a huge multimedia company as they were at the time. He thought they were going to be his title sponsor, but what he hadn't realised was that the person he'd been corresponding with had been sending emails from sonyericsson@hotmail.com and in fact was either a prankster or a fraudster. We never quite worked out what, but he announced the team, didn't he, and said, I'm going to launch this big team. He signed a lot of riders. Stuart O'Grady was one who was going to go to that team, I remember, and it never happened, and it was a case of not paying enough attention to the small print, I think, there for Giancarlo.
Bit of a dinosaur, old Giancarlo, I think. Anyway, that's not quite the same as the situation. And we're pleased to offer Kilometre Zero for friends of the podcast who, as you say, Lionel, are sponsors of the podcast. We're very grateful indeed to them. If you want to become a friend of the podcast, to listen to Kilometre Zero, become a friend of the podcast at thecyclingpodcast.com. Here's a little reminder of what the music sounds like.
Listen to Kilometre Zero, our morning show at the Vuelta a España, by becoming a friend of the Cycling Podcast at thecyclingpodcast.com.
So yeah, as you heard there, become a friend of the podcast at cyclingpodcast.com. Our very first kilometre zero of the Vuelta on Monday morning will be a feature on Aqua Blue, the Irish team making their Grand Tour debut here. I've been speaking to quite a few of their riders and staff and so on to get the build-up to the team time trial and the team time trial itself. Of all the stages to make your debut on a Grand Tour, team time trial is definitely the most stressful, and there was a lot of stress and nerves around the team. It was really quite interesting to speak to them about that. So that's coming out on Monday. I did speak to Adam Blythe after the team time trial, and they put in a decent performance, actually, Aqua Blue. Adam Blythe, very, very bullish about tomorrow's second stage. Let's hear from him now.
You know, we're not just here to ride around it either. We're here to be successful in it as well, you know, not go for cheesy and stuff like that, but just get out there. He wants as much profile as he can, and as I said to the guys, there's no better profile than success. So I think we've just got to, you know, we're not here to get in willy-nilly breaks for the fun of it. We're here to try and be successful.
And what about you? What are your personal ambitions here?
Win tomorrow. That's it, really, mate. Win tomorrow and then assess from there. That's my big goal, you know. Try and really get stuck in tomorrow and try and get a really good result. You know, I think the dream will be to win it, but whatever I get, as long as I've done everything I can, I'll be happy with.
Well, there's an opportunity, isn't there? Because there aren't a lot of sprint stages and there aren't a lot of the top sprinters here.
Yeah, for sure. And I think tomorrow, you know, it suits me quite a bit. Windy all day, and I've not done a Grand Tour in a while where there's been, you know, big GC teams, so it'll be a bit different to your normal just riding around in a peloton and getting on a sprint. It's all day stressful, you know, so just got to save as much energy as I can through the day and then just get the lead out right and hopefully we nail it.
So there we are. Adam Blythe is going to win the stage tomorrow.
Well, why not? There's hardly any sprinters here. It's going to be a showdown between John Degenkolb and Adam Blythe. They're going to be 200 metres clear of everybody else.
And there is Juan José Lobato also. Come on, he won a stage on the Tour de Lain last week. He's probably going to fly tomorrow.
Okay, well, lots to look forward to. Anyway, we should wrap things up for tonight and order dinner, I think. Fran, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me, despite my broken voice.
Well, we hope that recovers. Lionel, thank you.
Thank you, Richard.
Daniel, thank you very much.
Thank you.